Malcolm was making fun of the fact that I'm the special guest speaker at a very small crowd compared to what he's used to speaking to tomorrow.
Well, this Shabbos I'm going to the Kozel Bar Mitzvah in Teaneck, so Mazel Tov to them and to the box and all the family.
Very nice.
A double Bar Mitzvah, twins.
Are you going to be asked to speak?
Nope.
And by the way, if Malcolm looks a little sleepy tonight as they serve the soup, have rachmanis on him. Because of us, he ended up being up all night Thursday night, Friday morning, and maybe he'll catch a little cat nap this
afternoon. It's unfortunately normal for many Thursday nights, but yes, especially once serious this getting up at 5 to leaving at 5 to make sure I got here on time because of the threats you made against me.
And what happened? Veterans
I got here
Day,
early.
Very little traffic, thank God. 201-209-9368. Malcolm Honlein is here. Good morning, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to know about Iron Dome, the schedule of deployment. It seems that if there's a battery in Ashkelon, it doesn't cover Be'er Sheva. At what point will Iron Dome cover most of the South and ultimately the rest of the country?
Very sophisticated question. Good one. The answer is that right now there are three batteries of Iron Dome deployed. There are more under construction, and they are moved. They're mobile, and they're moved to different places. The problem is that Hamas or Islamic Jihad, those firing the missiles, see wherever they see there are interceptions of the missiles. So they move, and it's very easy for them to move because they have the rockets that they shoot cost $100 and are just from simple launchers, and they can move them around and redirect them. The Iron Dome, each time it's fired, costs between $50,000 and $100,000. So you're using a $100,000 missile to take down a $50, $100, $200 missile. The second thing is that they shoot then now mass barrages, so the Iron Dome system can only hit a certain number. What the computers there do is detect which missiles are likely to hit in populated areas and take it down. That's why they've taken down the Grad missiles, which are very dangerous, that we're going to hit in Be'er Sheva. So, number one, they're developing more systems. Two, they're moving them around and improving on the capability of it. It works. It has taken down many missiles, and they have to, to try and anticipate what the target. So they try to protect the big cities with the Iron Dome, and unfortunately, that makes other areas vulnerable.
And totally different subject, but I just came across it as I'm looking at Twitter. Mrs. Netanyahu...
And not listening to me.
Right, sorry about that. Mrs. Netanyahu lost her...
Father.
Father.
Her father. Her mother died a while ago. Her father, she's sitting Shiva now for her father. Mr. Ben Artzi.
Oh, so...
Who wrote a book about Navarre.
So is that possible? He writes on Twitter, if I know my Hebrew, that Sarah Netanyahu was his first grade teacher. Is that possible?
It's very possible.
I guess so, yeah. Is that funny? Yeah, why not? Just a little tidbit for your next cocktail party, Mr. Homeline. You're on the air with Malcolm Homeline. Good morning.
Good morning, Malcolm.
Go ahead, Dave. What's your question?
Good morning, Malcolm.
Good morning.
I have two questions for you. First off, like everyone in the free world, I was overjoyed when Gilad Shalit was finally released. But at some point, when does Israel stand up and say, listen, we're not releasing any more terrorists, number one, and B, if you kill one more Jew, we're going to make you pay?
What do you say?
Well, that is the message they've tried to put out, that if you kill any Jews, we pay. And Israel retaliates immediately now. There isn't a delay. The Air Force goes, and in fact, as soon as they have an indication that there's a potential attack, they eliminate them, those engaged in it, before they carry it out. And the drone technology has been very valuable, and Israeli aircraft are over Gaza constantly. There are other systems that they have developed to monitor this. So they do try to eliminate them before they do it. And these are strikes against specific leaders and individuals engaged in these activities. Look, the Gilad Shalit thing is something that is still debated and discussed and
will be for decades.
And will always be a question because there's no simple answer to it. Is there any value placed in the fact that a Jewish life was saved, that we were able to bring him home? The question is, will people pay with their lives in the future? One reason why I would never want to be the prime minister, because every decision, and I discussed this on the air, so I won't go over it again, but it is a terrible decision. But the window there was closing too. You know, we don't know what will happen in Egypt when the Muslim Brotherhood, which is now contesting 77% of the seats, not the 30 they said, or 40% or 50%, because they're looking at the Salafists now who are running their own list and saying they're going to get 30%. All of a sudden, they're saying, hey, we were going to get 40% and take control. Now we may have real competition. In addition to the other parties and the coalitions that were formed, it starts in November and goes through March. That's for the parliament. And then you have the constitutional committee that's supposed to write the constitution, and then the presidential election in 2013. I happened to talk to Amr Moussa this week, who's the prime candidate for president of Egypt, and he is contesting it. They want to move up the election for the presidency.
The polls look good for him, huh?
Well, for him right now, but it's not no shoo-in. And Al-Baradei is running, who I mentioned before, and other candidates. But the Muslim Brotherhood is not putting forward a candidate for the reasons that I talked to you about before, is that they don't want responsibility. They want control. And they thought they would have control with 40%, which would have been true, and you had 45 other parties, each with a small amount. Now they see the Salafists, who are more extreme even than the Muslim Brotherhood, but with the potential, the four parties that formed an Islamic alliance, running a list as well. So we don't know what the outcome of this will be. The generals, by the way, are looking to extend their influence and limiting the power of what the new parliament will be able to do. They're appointing a constitutional committee. The generals want to appoint 80% of the members. We'll see whether that actually is able to be carried out.
By the way, on the Shalit thing, I don't know if you saw it or not, but it was either two or three Saturdays ago, Sam Friedman, full disclosure, brother of our very own Ken Friedman here at WFMU, had what I thought was a brilliant article in the religion section of the New York Times analyzing, you know, how it is that there is a tradition like this among our people, you know, explaining it to people who aren't familiar with Jewish tradition of, you know, what price you pay to get one of our own home, you know, someone who's being held prisoner.
And you know that some of the polls and stuff show that it resonated really with the American people, that the Gilad Shalit case touched the American people as a whole. And just recent numbers that I saw over the last 24 hours seem to indicate that it had a profound impact, and the value of life, as opposed to the opposition who valued death, that this is really in the tradition of V'charta V'chayim, that Avraham Avinu was told to choose life. And there is no price. And we've had people, the Maral, others, who said, you know, you don't ransom. But this is different. You have a Jewish government with the opportunity to save a Jewish life. And hopefully they will do what's necessary to make sure that those released do not commit any further attacks.
201-209-9368, your chance to speak with Malcolm Homeland and ask your questions. You're on the air. Hi. Hi, you're on the air. Sorry about that. Where are we?
Why don't you let the operator ask that question?
You're on the air. Hi.
Yes, hello. I'm calling from Switzerland. I've been listening for over 20 years.
Thank you. Wow.
I have a question. Here on this side of the Atlantic, the news media are, of course, not exactly our friends. And the problem, they always, whatever they put into print or on the radio, is pretty much always one-sided. We're used to that, so we're glazed over when we hear that. The problem is when other Jewish people who are not so well informed of what's going on here, that they also start to take the wrong side of the equation, and they start to blame Israel for not knowing how to keep peace, not knowing how to be sensible, etc., etc. What can you, with your knowledge, do for us here in Europe to get the message across?
Well, first of all, thank you for listening, and from Switzerland, and I hope you're sending us some chocolate. but you're asking a very important question on a number of levels. One is that we are experiencing that here, too. Our media in our campuses, the same things that have happened in Europe are happening here. This campaign of delegitimization is global, except the Europeans have been dealing with it for a lot longer. And if I might say so, I think European Jewish leadership have always been very shy. It has to do with the demographics. It has to do with the nature of the systems. It has to do with many things. But Jewish leadership tends not to be outspoken or activists. And we have invested, others have invested a great deal working with them to try to show them how we do things. And we share now messages. We work with many of the communities. And believe me, I do understand the circumstances under which they operate, the difficulties, the problems that they have, and increasingly having with the growing Muslim populations, et cetera. So the answer is we now have a global coalition for Israel where we sit with the Europeans and South Africans, Australians, and others to work together to see to it that some of the initiatives and programs, you know, we have this America's Voices in Israel, which brings leading spokesmen of every field, top movie actors, Christian leaders, diplomats, and others, and we're sharing that program with Europeans. We have many other...
I want to see athletes go.
We're working on athletes. Actually, we're just doing now, preparing a mission for top athletes.
Get Michael Jordan to visit Israel.
Well, we're looking for not Hasmans. We're going for my future guys. But I don't think if he may be, but the bed, there's no beds long enough for him. So, and many other programs. I won't go into all of it, but one of the lessons we learned is that we can learn a lot from Europe also here, because they're the laboratory where it happened first, particularly Great Britain in the case of America. But what we can do is help embolden, help strengthen the hands of them, provide information, provide guidance, work together. We do every year events together with the Eurasian Jewish Congress, with other groups, the European Jewish Union now. I just was in Kiev with them. And we see a lot of dynamic leadership. This was in Ukraine, but in Russia and other parts of the New Europe especially, you see really wonderful emerging young people. I spoke at an event in Kiev for 2,500 people came from every part of the Ukraine. When you ask them what the Jewish population of Ukraine is, they say between 150,000 and 400,000. Everybody says, because nobody knows. But I literally saw young people and older people coming together. And so what we can do is by working together, by bringing all of our mutual strengths, by strengthening one another. Because what we see, what at the UN, it's not just the United States. If we don't have the Europeans behind us, the EU is an important player. And now going through this transitional phase, which we did anticipate, you know, might be right now stopping, but fundamentally Europe is important. And I think by acting as Am Echad, working together, using each other, respecting each other, that we can help make each other effective.
When he said the media on that side of the Atlantic, I thought he meant the Israeli media.
No, there's a stop before that.
Just a little joke,
yeah,
Mr. Homeland.
Not funny.
You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Marilyn Taffet. I do have a question.
Sure, go right ahead.
What do you know about a breakthrough at the Yitzhak Rabin Hospital on Parkinson's?
I don't know. I did see a report about it, but, you know, every day in Israel, but literally every day, there are incredible discoveries, breakthroughs in every area, particularly in the medical area, on MS, on breast cancer, on other diseases. Just in the last short while, I know that there were amazing things. And I know Americans who are going there for treatments. In the biotech, medtech area, Israel is amazing. I just saw this week is a group called Tevel, T-E-V-E-L, for any of the VCs, venture capitalists out there who are interested in investing in startup companies in Israel. We saw things, one that has denatured medical marijuana.
Wow.
And taken away the problem. There's no high, there's nothing. It's really done in a unique and sophisticated way. Another one that developed a special kind of device that can withdraw blood clots whole, just suck it out from the vein. And another that developed a device for Africa, you know, because circumcision cuts HIV by 60%.
Right.
And this is a no surgery, no nothing. It's just a device that is used. It's not kosher for Milan, but it's it's been tested in Rwanda and other countries with great success. I mean, it's just, I'm giving you a sampling of the areas that we saw just in this one display where they brought five or six companies to present what they're doing.
Unbelievable.
Aside from all the high-tech areas. So the answer is that it's very likely there's stuff on Parkinson's. I know they're doing extensive research on Parkinson's. And if you have something specific, let Nachum know, and we'll try and find out for you.
We'll try to take another question or two before we wrap up. Don't forget, Malcolm's a great next synagogue a week from tonight. He'll be this Shabbos in Teaneck at a simcha, but next Shabbos, a great next synagogue with Q&A and more. You'll have a chance to ask some questions out there. Send our best regards to Great Neck. You're on the air. Hi. You are on the air. Hi. Lower your radio and ask your question.
What if they lowered a question?
There goes that. Hi, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
One is the 700 or 70,000 barrels of enriched uranium in Libya that was discovered.
There weren't 70,000. It was 7,000. And it is true that they found two things. One is chemical weapons. It wasn't enriched uranium. It's chemical weapons that were not disclosed. And I'm sorry. There's two things. One was chemical weapons, two huge deposits, storage facilities. Then there were 7,000 units of enriched uranium that were found, which were leftovers of his nuclear program. They haven't tested yet to get a full picture of whether this is depleted or not, but it indicates to you, and it really is an indication of a much more serious problem, and that is that tens of thousands of weapons that were in these places that he hid them and were found by these rebel groups that now run the country. And the warning I gave a long time ago about who we're dealing with here, you see more and more that the Al-Qaeda and really bad guys, that a lot of these weapons were being sold. Egypt in one night stopped five shipments, convoys going to Gaza. We know one of the missiles that already hit Beersheba had the markings of a Russian sail to Libya, so they know that that stuff is getting out. And now the United States, Britain, and others have sent troops in there, former soldiers and others, to try and trace all the stuff down, to lock up the storage unit. The government in charge there is not doing it. People are seen walking in the streets with five Kalashnikovs or other rifles and other equipment that they took out of these things to sell and to give to potentially terrorist organizations. So the answer is it's something that they just discovered in the last few days, the uranium, and we'll get a report on it.
What's your second question?
The second question is more of a broad policy question. To this moment, I still don't understand if Abbas can get away with saying we have to have a settlement freeze before we'll talk. Why can't Israel say we have to have you recognize a Jewish state before we'll talk?
That is what Netanyahu said.
And, but we're criticized for that.
And
he's saying
Israel,
that we get criticized.
I understand. And I mean, that's exactly what Netanyahu said, is that he wants this as if the other guy's putting down preconditions. And by the way, as you know, it wasn't Abbas who first put it down. It was President Obama in a speech who first raised this issue of a settlement freeze. We had and the Oslo Accords do not say that construction has to stop. It does say that you can't change the status of the West Bank, which is exactly what this UN effort by Abbas is intended to do. I think that they may not go for the vote at the Security Council because he knows he doesn't have the 9 votes. I do think then he will go to the General Assembly. He may force the vote in order just to embarrass the United States and or to come back to it later on when we have the new Security Council after January 1st. So the answer is, I think, absolutely right. If they're putting down preconditions, Netanyahu's put down his, and that is that he's got to say it. And he said again now, in the last few days, that he will never recognize it as a Jewish state. The answer is because he doesn't believe Israel should exist, and that is why he denies our heritage there. That's why he, Abbas himself, participates in the delegitimization of Israel and the integration, why he talks about the 47 armistice agreement, failure to accept it as a mistake, not because he's criticizing those at the time, because he wants to go back to 47 and negotiate when there was no state of Israel, because that's the borders he wants.
Malcolm, great job as usual. Thank you so much for coming in.
As pleasure.
As I always say at the end of these conversations, I agree. Have a great Shabbos. There
great
he is,
Shabbos.
Malcolm Holite, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents. I thank him for being here to answer your questions at JM and the AM.